afternoon, everyone. It's Hometown Alaska, and I'm Charles Woolforth. Welcome to our show today. It's a special one. Iditarod starts this weekend. There's a lot of excitement in the air. Beautiful winter weather outside. Great for running dogs. And we have an array of guests today to get ready for the race and talk about what they're doing and what their hopes are. And also a couple of journalists who can talk about the field. And it's going to be an exciting show. And I hope that you can get involved with questions and with your thoughts about the race, how you follow it, who your favorite mushers are, what you like to see happen out there this year. And you can give us a call at 550-8433. Well, my first guest today is Dallas Seavey, who is well-known to Alaskans now since he won the Yukon Quest this year, becoming the youngest musher ever to do so at age 23. And now he will attempt to be only the second musher ever to win both the Quest and the Iditarod. He was also the youngest musher ever to run the Iditarod, turning 18 the day before his rookie race. And I guess, Dallas, that means you're about to turn 24 before your race this year. Is that right?
That is correct. We turned 24 on the 4th.
All right. So tell me, what is it? What are your days like these days? You're going from this brutal, really, really tough Yukon Quest race and now getting ready for the Iditarod. What's it take to do that turnaround and get ready to go?
It's the focus, as always, is on the sled dogs and getting them ready to do both races. So I've been doing a lot of training in between. I've been putting on a lot of miles on the sled between these two races, working with the dogs that I had on the Quest and also the dogs that stayed home, getting everybody prepared. So very busy. It's a little bit different than the past, where usually we're getting all the last-minute stuff ready to go on the sled and everything, but we kind of did that a month ago, getting ready for the Quest. So we have everything ready, and it's kind of nice just being able to focus on the sled dogs.
Yeah. So you have a different, slightly different team for each race?
It's primarily the same team, but we're only able to start the Quest with 14 dogs, and it takes, you start the Iditarod with 16. So already there's going to be a few different dogs in the Iditarod kind of that you're adding to your team. Also, there's always, you have to expect that some dog may have an injury or something that might prohibit him from running in the Iditarod. It looks right now like 12 of the dogs that were on the Yukon Quest with me will be racing the Iditarod, and I have 4 others that will be sitting in. Most of those dogs are some of my older dogs that I opted not to have do both races this year.
I want to bring in another voice here, and this gentleman may have some questions for you as well. Craig Medred is on the line with us from, I think he's somewhere out on the trail. Craig, can you hear me?
Yeah, Charles, it's funny that Mr. Seavey's on because I'm sitting here kind of right next to the tree where Pat Moon went out last year, and a young musher from Belgium who trained with the Seavey saved him.
And you're calling us by satellite phone. Boy, you're clear as a bell. And so where are you exactly?
I'm just a little bit, it would be east of the confluence of Pass Fork and Dalzell Creek in the Alaska Range, which for everyone familiar with the Iditarod Trail is pretty much where the Dalzell Gorge starts here, another mile down from me.
Oh, Craig, you can give some probably valuable information to our musher Dallas Seavey on the phone. What's the trail look like this year? Is it in pretty good shape?
Hello.
Yeah, we still hear you.
Most of it's hard and fast, and there's a lot more snow once you get over Rainy Pass than there was last year. It's actually at this moment, at this very moment, a far, far better trail than they had last year.
I see. So tell me, Dallas, what kind of trail favors you? I know that the Quest was really tough this year, and you seemed to come through it, whereas others were unable to even finish the race, and even some of the giants of that race were unable to finish it. Do you prefer tough conditions? Do you prefer easy conditions? What favors you competitively?
That's a very good question. Competitively, I do prefer a tough trail. I feel like the more adversity on the trail, the better we're going to do. However, we strive to train a dog team that's capable to handle really any trail. The trail and the weather is the number one factor when we're racing out there, and it's an incredible variable. It can be 180 degrees different from one year to the next. So I think the key is to train a team that's not specific to any one trail, but is a well-rounded team that can handle any conditions, because we will undoubtedly see a lot of different conditions in any given race.
So is that because you have trained a certain way that you like tough conditions, or just because you're a tough kid?
I think it's a combination. I do like to seek out difficult situations for my dog teams. You know, deep snow, wind, water, whatever it takes. I like to have a team that's prepared for everything. It's only fair to the dogs to have them exposed to all the elements before we see it on the race. Mm-hmm. You can't expect your dog team to handle, you know, super strong winds on Rainy Pass or on the Bering Sea coast if they've never seen it before. It's only fair to them to have them prepared for all conditions. Also, I do think the age factor is a benefit to me.
Right.
Dallas, what was...
Go ahead, Craig.
Can I get a question in here? So, Dallas, what was it like to run a race where you could go out, you know, easily and kind of build into it instead of Iditarod, where you really, really have to race to the range just to get through there before the trail goes to pieces?
It was really nice, honestly. I honestly really enjoyed the Yukon Quest, especially starting the race with a more relaxed schedule. Going into the race, we didn't really intend on winning the race, but preparing our dog team for the Iditarod was the number one goal. And as it turned out, that more conservative early race really played a major factor in our ability to win the race later on, having a stronger team when we hit the bad conditions.
So in the Iditarod, you really have to hit it pretty hard from the beginning. And I guess your top Iditarod finish was what, eighth? Sixth?
I was eighth last year. I was sixth the year before.
All right. What is it? I've always wondered this. I'd like to hear this from both of you guys with different perspectives. What is the difference between an eighth place winner and a first place winner? Is it luck? I mean, because it seems like they're all, you know, super dog teams and super mushers, and you kind of wonder what divides them.
Go ahead, Greg. Well, why don't you take that
year,
first?
Last year, the difference was it one key bad decision by the guy in front.
Right, strategy. Yeah, that obviously makes
sense. I'm convinced that if John Baker hadn't had that stop, and Dallas, you can weigh in here, because I think you're the guy who found him out there stopped, I think he would have won the race.
You know, it's impossible to say what may have happened. We all know Mackie is a major factor, and he'll do what it takes to win. So had he had more pressure, maybe not. Maybe he could have stepped it up. However, I think Hans Gott was a major factor in that race. I think he had the best dog team in the race. I think he made a few errors at the end of the race, and some of it, from talking to him, was due to his own physical ability and the shape that he was in. Maybe after having won the Quest last year, maybe that took a toll on his body. But to answer the question as far as the difference between a first and an eighth place team, the athletes of the team is a major factor. You have to have the dogs that are able to do the schedule. Last year there was 10 hours between me and first. So part of it is the dogs, part of it is the strategies that you use and the experience that the musher has and how the dogs have been trained. But I think the core of it is the athletes. And in those top five or six teams last year, the athletes were incredibly comparable. And it comes down to training and what the mushers are able to do on the race and if they can pull it off at the end.
Well, tell me about the physical training for the musher. You know, you've got to be ready to obviously go on a lack of sleep. What about just the physical training in terms of your endurance and your ability to handle situations? I mean, it's different from other sports in that women are competitive in mushing. What does it take exactly to get your body ready?
I think the best thing to get your body, the person, ready is really the same thing that it takes to get the dogs ready, and that's just training. I don't have any special regimen that I do on the side, weightlifting or running or swimming. It's really working with the dogs and working with the sleep deprivation. That is a major factor out there. And how I train, I do simulated races all year long. We train our routine in the checkpoints. We're efficient there. I do the same short rest. I'm used to taking those 40-minute naps, and I feel like I get more that short rest because I've done that. On each year, I'll do about 50 of those camps throughout the year, and I'm used to that routine.
Wow. Say, I want to give you an opportunity to mention who's paying for all this, because I know it's really expensive, and also mention, you know, that you're a family affair. Your dad is racing this year, and I believe is wearing number one. Do you guys, like, have the same sponsors, or how do you work together? Are you competing against each other? How does that work?
That's a good question. It's kind of complicated. Well, I shouldn't say it's complicated, but there's a lot of different guesses as to what the situation is. But for the most part, we are completely separate. I live in Willow. My dad lives in Sterling. He has his kennel. I have my kennel. We have similar bloodlines. My wife and I got into mushing. We opted to go on with those bloodlines because that's what I was familiar with. How I raised is kind of particular to that type of dog. We do share a sponsor of sorts. I have a major sponsor, and that is J.J. Keller & Associates. They're based out of Neenah, Wisconsin. And they have supported me since 2007. And they also have a smaller sponsorship that reaches out to my dad because of the family connection there. And it's kind of made a nice, it's a nice partnership. I shouldn't say partnership, that's the wrong word. But, it brings us all together. It's the family thing, but we've competitors out there. Come race day, we're still probably best friends, but, if he's the team ahead of me, I'm trying to catch him.
Yeah, I bet. What do you think, Craig? Who would you pick out of these two guys?
Well, I think Dallas has got the smarts and the training dialed in. I mean, sleep deprivation is where it's at. We've had lots of really good mushers who never really excelled in Iditarod because of that, and it's one of those things Hans has always struggled with. There's a fair amount of luck here, and there's that unknown element that, dog teams are like people. Sometimes they do more than they think they can, and I know in talking to a lot of people, I know in talking to Martin, the year he set the course record, it was kind of one of those phenomenal things where things just came together, and if you've ever, done much serious running or bike racing or anything where you hit that point where you're really fatigued and all of a sudden you're not, and Martin had that kind of happen with a dog team, and they went to the next level and it was a dream ride. Now how you dial that in every day, there's a lot of mushers out there trying to figure that out.
Yeah, well, I want to note something else, that Dallas in the Junior Iditarod won the Sportsmanship Award, the Humanitarian Award, a couple of times. And Craig, you were mentioning this incident that happened last year. For the listeners, could Craig give us the quick thumbnail sketch about what happened, and then we can go to Dallas to get his perspective on it.
There was a young man by the name of Pat Moon from Chicago who trained to run Iditarod. Suffers from non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. There was a really bad trail last year. He got beat up all the way across Rainy Pass. I mean, it was a really, really tough trail to ride. He would have been in good shape this year. This trail, he would have been fine. It was a really tough trail to ride. He finally got across Rainy Pass and down into the first of the timber here at the head of Dalzell, and the sled went sliding sideways with sleds do, and he was so tired and fatigued he didn't have enough control of himself, and he went head first into a tree, and Sam Del Tour, who trained with the Seavies there, found him passed out in the trail, and Sam, being a medical student, did what all dog mushers would do. He made sure that the team was tied off and safe, and then he went to check on Pat.
Right. And Dallas, I mean, is that an important part of mushing for you, that's not just cutthroat, that you are out there sort of helping each other out to some extent?
Absolutely, yes. Most of the top mushers, they can take care of themselves pretty dang well. They're not out there as disoriented as maybe some of the back mushers. It's just an experience factor. So it's not a common occurrence that we're always saving each other. But yes, it's a race, but more so, I mean, we're crossing Alaska by a dog team. If somebody has a serious issue, anybody will help them. I've never seen a team just blow on by somebody with a problem. Even if somebody's just camping and nothing's wrong, people oftentimes stop and just make sure everything's all right, make sure they have, enough food or whatever. For the most part, mushers are fairly independent people. They want to be able to take care of themselves, but everybody is willing to help somebody out. There's always a race next year. You only get to die once.
Hey, I really want to thank both of you guys for being on. Go ahead, Craig. One last comment.
I was just going to say, that's kind of an unwritten rule out here in general. I mean, you just, I'm a long, long way from nobody at the moment with an Iridium satellite phone and a few bikers on the trail. And, it's just a force of habit. You ask everybody if they're okay, if they're stopped. If they're not moving, they could have a problem. And it's just kind of a different way of life.
Yeah. Hey, Craig, I want to thank you for calling in. Craig Medrid is covering the Iditarod Invitational right now for Alaska Dispatch. And I guess you'll be covering the Iditarod sled dog race in a little while, right, Craig? You're going to be out there the whole time?
And I hope those guys get as nice a conditions as the cyclists and runners got, because Peter Basinger is at this moment pedaling into McGrath, I think, for a new course record, which is like 3 days, which makes him as fast as a husky.
Wow, amazing. Okay, well, thanks to Craig Medrid from Alaska Dispatch. Thanks for Dallas Seavey, who is, I believe, driving down the Parks Highway on his way into town to get ready for the race. You've both been great. I really appreciate your being on the show with me.
Absolutely.
Okay, thanks a lot. My name is Charles Wolforth. The show is Hometown Alaska. As you've probably figured out, we're talking Iditarod. The race starts this weekend, and it's so beautiful outside. It just looks like a day made for dog mushing, and I hope it stays like this. It's going to be really fun to be out there. Listen, we're interested in your calls, your reactions, your thoughts about the race, your questions for the mushers and the journalists that we're going to have on the air. You can call in here at 550-8433. That's if you're calling from here in town. Outside of Anchorage, there's a toll-free number, 888-353-5752. Of course, we're on the air in the 2 o'clock hour, so don't call in if you're listening to the rebroadcast at 7. We also take emails at hometownalaska@kska.org. And you can also find links to the folks that we're talking to at kska.org. You may be interested in that as well. Now I'd like to invite and welcome Kyle Hopkins to the air, reporter for the Anchorage Daily News. Kyle?
Hi, Charles.
Well, thanks so much for being with us. I know you have a really busy day in covering the race and the preparations for the race. You're going to be covering the Iditarod for the Daily News all the way along the way, I guess, and covered it last year as well?
That's right. This is only my second year covering it, but we'll hit the trail on Monday.
All right. So what's going on today? What are the preparations that the mushers are making right now?
Well, I just got back into Anchorage from Wasilla, where they were doing the vet check this morning, and anticipated that they would have maybe 30 teams, maybe three dozen teams that they would do the vet check on, so that, you know, kind of the physicals on the dogs that are required before the race. And then they're doing some maybe like last minute blood work or like EKG stuff on dogs that they needed to recheck that they've been checking over the past couple weeks. And then the mushers, the few mushers I talked to, it seemed that as they would leave the vet check, a lot of them were headed out to do like 10 or 20 mile runs just to get their dogs some time outside and let them stretch their legs outside the dog boxes a little bit.
Uh-huh. And what is a vet check? That's essentially looking at the dogs and making sure they're healthy enough to run the race, right?
Yeah, my understanding is that it's just kind of like a physical that you'd have, like your annual physical. You know, I think they put hands on each of the dogs, and they're checking for dehydration and they can, you know, the overall condition of the dog. They are each new dog gets a microchip, kind of a microchip that's specific to the Iditarod. So they kind of, that dog is now has a chip in like in its shoulder. So that identifies it as a specific like Iditarod dog that they then check that chip, you know, at the start to make sure that it's the same dog.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now this has been a big year for the animal rights folks, PETA, to take shots at the race. The TSA had some kind of a $75,000 sponsorship deal for recruiting security screeners, which seemed like an odd deal, but I guess that's been canceled. I understand some sponsors of the race have been receiving mass emails from PETA supporters. Is that something that you're hearing about as you're covering the race, that there's more pressure this year than usual?
I don't know about more than usual. I mean, I don't have the historic perspective to know how, you know, I mean, PETA has, you know, they've never liked the race. I think they always pressure sponsors. I don't know what their strategy is. If they, you know, if they saw that TSA on the list and thought, well, this is, you know, because I imagine they would assume that they would have less success with Alaska sponsors than they would with national sponsors. So maybe they saw an opportunity through, you know, through TSA being, you know, a branch of the government, you know, outside of Alaska. I'm a little confused as to what happened there exactly, because I was surprised to hear yesterday that, I asked the race director yesterday, okay, so TSA pulled their sponsorship. Does that hurt the purse? Like, that, you know, does that affect the purse at all? And he said, well, no, they didn't pull any money, meaning that they paid, you know, they had a contractual obligation to the Iditarod, so they paid like $75,000 to the Iditarod. And even though they're no longer listed as a sponsor, my understanding is, you know, Iditarod still got that money. So it's kind of a lose-lose for TSA, because they lose money and they also, get a lot of bad publicity on both sides. I mean, they've given money to the Iditarod, but they also are not, don't even get anything in return.
Yeah, in a sense, they're buying the anger and resentment of Iditarod fans, right?
Right. Yeah. Who's going to be happy with them? It's not really PETA, and certainly not Iditarod fans. So that didn't turn out too well.
Yeah. Well. Is this the court? But it almost seems like the Iditarod is able to laugh it off at this point, because the critics have come after them so many years, and they're still strong and they're still doing what they do. And I wonder if they even pay that much attention to it anymore.
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't know if you saw the notes from Senator Begich and Senator Murkowski, who described PETA as the real critical. PETA described them as kind of the least credible of the animal rights groups. I haven't dealt with PETA that much. I haven't written about them or talked to them very much myself. So I can't really speak to that. But they don't seem to have much influence with the existing sponsors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're more of a fringe group, and some of the more mainstream groups seem to have backed off a little bit, I guess. So. Excuse me. I think our listeners would be interested in how you go about covering this race, and this goes to something that I've found interesting over the years. You think of about sports that are popular in other states, and there's usually something where you buy a ticket and go sit there, and you can watch the sport actually taking place. And Iditarod, in a sense, is like an invisible sporting event. You see them leave, and some people can go to know them and see them come in. And then you sort of follow them on the Iditarod, on the internet or on the radio in between. And so it's not really, in that sense, a spectator sport. And yet it develops a lot of excitement, and people follow it in the newspaper and follow it on your website. How do you go about knowing what's really going on out there?
Well, like I said, this will be my second time on the trail. And you know who's leading the same way that anybody else does, just kind of looking online, and in that sense you're almost more in the dark depending on where you're at. If you're not in the checkpoint itself, you're in a village where you might not have internet access and are not looking up Iditarod Insider or our website to see what the standings are. You're just kind of talking to people. So a lot of the reporting, so there's people here in Anchorage who are kind of, following it online and watching the leaders and stuff, because we don't really try and catch up with the leaders until later in the race. At the beginning, it's flying into the checkpoints, flying into the villages, and then just kind of hanging out and talking to people to the mushers as they come in about, what was the last, 12 hours like? How was your run into this particular checkpoint?
Do you find that do they tell the truth, or do they try to always tell you they're doing great and try to psych out the other mushers?
Boy, I don't hear too many people saying they're doing great. I mean, I think it depends on how far along you are into the race. But if someone's pretty beat up, they're in my experience, which again is limited, they're more than happy to let you know about how beat up they are. Maybe it's cathartic,
right.
Just try and share the misery a little bit, and you can see it. I mean, I was, I was just telling somebody, I was just kind of amazed just watching somebody pull into a checkpoint at the end of a long run, and they're messing with the booties and they're getting their gloves off and stuff. And you look at their hands look, just miserable. You can tell maybe there's frostbite or kind of the beginnings of it and stuff. And so, I mean, you can just kind of see how things went on their faces sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. So, listen, folks, if you want to get in on the conversation today, you can do so. Kyle Hopkins is my guest right now. He's a reporter for the Anchorage Daily News who is covering the Iditarod, knows a lot more about it than I do, certainly. The phone number, if you have questions for Kyle and for our other guests that will be coming up, including D.D. John Rowe and Zach Steer, who I'll have in the second half hour of the show. If you have questions or comments, call and get queued up. Phone number here is 550-8433. That's in town, outside of Anchorage. It's 888-353-5752. The email is hometownalaska@kska.org. Kyle, you mentioned this morning in the newspaper that the size of the purse for the Iditarod has actually declined. And I was wondering if what the reasons for that are and if that affects the mushers in any way. I mean, do you hear complaints or concerns about that?
You know, I think you heard that more last year. I mean, I'm sure there's still the same concerns and complaints, and maybe that's maybe that combined with the economy and they're you know, tied to each other certainly are the reason that you see such a small field this year. You know, this is a pretty small field for the Iditarod.
Something like 70 teams. It seems like a lot, but I guess it's less than some other years, huh?
Yeah, maybe 60.
Oh, really? Okay.
And you know, compared to like what a couple years ago was, you know, it's like pushing 100, right? And the purse was, of course, much larger. But, you know, I mean, where can you look around this year and see where people are spending more money or doing, you know, or handing out more money than they were, you know, 3 years ago? So, mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know how surprising that is. You know, if you talk to Iditarod folks, they'll say that they, you know, are happy about certain sponsorships that are new, including like I think the Eagle Pack sponsorship is a new one this year. But the money that the winner will get is the same as last year, but that was, I can't remember the number, but maybe 16,000-17,000 less than the year before that. So yeah, I mean, they're racing for less money, and I know that mushers are concerned about that because they've got you know, it costs a lot of money to keep a kennel, you know, and to feed those dogs and to care for those dogs and to have the time to kind of devote to that lifestyle.
Yeah, well, it seems like counting on prize money would be almost impossible because, I mean, the cost would never be made up except for the very top few, right? I mean, they'd have to have sponsorships or their own money that they're investing in it.
Yeah, I mean, if you're 30th, you win, or maybe 31st, you win like $1,000, right? And you're paying $4,000 to enter the race. So,
I got you.
You know, yeah, I don't know. You know, I'm certainly people have made money off it, but I think for the most part, people are doing it because, you know, that is just something they're passionate about. And the money is, they're just trying to find ways to make the money piece of it work.
Mm-hmm. So who do you look to when you're thinking about the mushers that I need to be talking to so that I know I'm talking to some of the people who are most likely to win? Who are the ones that you think are look the strongest this year?
Well, you know, I don't consider myself someone who you know, I'm not someone who should be handicapping the race. You know, I can tell you that, you know, I try and talk to, like I talked to Jeff King the other week, kind of asking him that question, right? I had that question for him. You know, who would you be talking to? Who do you think, right? And, you know, King had that kind of duel with Mackie last year, and you almost kind of sense that there's still some hard feelings and stuff, but, you know, you want to talk to the guys who came in the top five, the top 10 last year. I was really anxious to talk to Hans Gott last week just to hear how bad that frost might have been for him that he suffered on the Yukon Quest. You know, he had a real, you know, here's a guy who's won the Quest, was second last year in the Iditarod, and is kind of a, you know, he's a champion musher, but he had a really tough Quest. So I was curious to see, you know, how he's doing. I talked to Sebastian Schnullo a lot today, who was considered someone, you know, who the race director for the Quest said looked great, looked really good at the end of the Quest, that his dogs looked really good. I'm hoping to talk to Mackie tomorrow, maybe at the Mushers meeting. You know, those guys, Ken Anderson, John Baker, Dallas, you know, I think you want to talk to all the top 10, and then, you know, and then that's not even including like Martin Boozer, right? Who was 14th right. last year.
So are these guys fairly cagey when you're talking to them at the beginning, or are they pretty open about what their strategy is and their strengths and weaknesses?
I think it depends on the guy. I mean, I would say they're less cagey than like, you know, I was like my first reporting job was, I was a sports reporter, and I'd say they're less cagey than talking to like a basketball player or like a baseball player. Right. You know, in terms of cliches and not telling you anything. You know, like when I talked to Schnullo today, he was saying, you know, that here's a guy who's been threatening to kind of get out of mushing for a while and is anxious to, and considers himself a really conservative musher, right? Like he doesn't take a lot of big risks, whereas it's the opposite of Matt, right? Who's kind of for going for broke. So, you know, he was saying that, yeah, you know, this might be my last year or one of them. So I'm just going to kind of go for it this year, maybe take risks that I wouldn't have in the past. So that's interesting. I mean, you got to take it at face value.
See how it plays out. Yeah. Well, thanks a lot for being with us, Kyle. I've been talking with Kyle Hopkins, who is a reporter for the Anchorage Daily News. we'll be covering the Iditarod this year. And I appreciate your being with us. I know you have a busy day. When we come back from our break, I'll be talking with Didi Jonro, and I'll give you that phone number one more time if you have questions for Didi Jonro or for Zach Steer, who will be with us a little bit later in the hour. You're listening to Hometown Alaska, and I'm Charles Wolforth. We'll be back soon.
If you missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen again to Hometown Alaska on KSKA, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. A copy of Hometown Alaska will be available this afternoon on our website at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. Charles Wolforth on Hometown Alaska. We're going to be talking now with Didi Jonro, one of everybody's favorite mushers. And I want to let you know how you can get in on the conversation. The number here is 550-8433. Outside Anchorage, it's 888-353-5752. We take emails at hometownalaska@kska.org. Didi Jonro, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much. Just got to add a quick comment. I was listening to Kyle a few minutes ago, and I think one preliminary thing he left out in evaluating the potential teams at the top of this year, anybody that won preliminary races this season.
Mm-hmm.
So if he were to look at that, he would have to give me a second look.
All right. I think everybody assumes you're going to be near the top every year because you're such a veteran and you have posted these amazing performances over time. And but you've never quite been the first under the Burled Arch. And I wonder if you're, is this the year? I mean, are you really hungry for it this year?
Well, not only hungry for it, but I've had a good season myself personally and a good season with the team. The team has done really well this year. So I feel that things are stacking up and looking in my favor. But anything can happen out there. Ask Hugh Neff.
Yeah. Well, I mean, for those who, I'm sure you must be one of the most famous Alaskans out there, but Didi Jonro is a musher who's certainly the top female musher in the world and has had 14 top 10 finishers in her career. She's been as high as fifth. And
as high as second twice.
I'm sorry. Whoa. Sorry. I should be more careful with my facts. So when did you get into mushing and when did you realize that it was going to be something that would be like a huge part of your life for a long time?
Well, I first started driving dogs when I was living in Bethel. And that was in, actually, the first time I ran a team was in 1979, but my first Iditarod was in 1980. And at that time, it was just an opportunity to spend time with dogs and travel in the Delta and share the culture with the people I was living with out there. You know, I didn't really see it as a lifetime occupation, and really, nobody was making a living doing that back in those days.
Mm-hmm. That's there pretty were, near the start of the race, yeah.
Yeah, those of us that were running, you know, I've run all but 10 of the Iditarods, and those of us that were running, you know, also all had different jobs and were supporting our teams in other ways as well, and there was no such thing as handlers or, you know, qualifying races or anything like that. And most of us ran dogs at night and on the weekends and worked full-time at something, either seasonally or, you know, as a year-round occupation. And I didn't even think it was a dream possible to be able to run dogs, you know, all the time. And I think being able to turn it into an occupation was pioneered by Susan and Rick and
mm-hmm.
some of the earlier drivers that saw the possibility of being able to work as spokespersons for different companies and stuff, as well as be able to support a kennel in that manner. And as I got more and did more and more races, I found my heart looking out the window and wishing I was out there.
Mm-hmm.
And starting then to see how I could best make that come true. And in 1983, I resigned from the Department of Fish and Game as a fisheries biologist for the Delta out there and went to work as a commercial fisherman seasonally, and eventually we're also working for some of the different fish companies, buying fish for them and such, and started being able to spend my entire winter towards developing my dog team.
Well, it's interesting because not only there are very few mushers who have been at it that long, and maybe, I don't know if there's any who have run the race as many times as you have. You'd have to...
Rick Swenson.
Oh, okay.
Rick and Martin. Rick has run it more than me, and Martin and I are running it the same number of times, with Martin having an additional finish over me because of a couple of times I've had to scratch.
Yeah. Well, and one of the, you know, you have a lot of inspirational parts to your story, and I'm sure there's a lot more than we can talk about in 15 minutes, but one of the things I wanted to ask about is that you're one of those who did make the transition from the early days of the race when it was more of an amateur race of just tough folks going out there and doing it somewhat, you know, for fun, for competition, but not necessarily a professional way of life, to what it is now, where you have mushers who essentially have been raised in professional competitive mushing. We were talking to Dallas Seavey earlier in the hour, who is sort of weaned on dog mushing and is in, and so you've seen both. And I'm interested in your comparison of those two ways. I mean, is it as fun as it was back then?
Well, it is for me, you know, because every year is like a brand new experience you have. I think it's like a school teacher looking forward to the class that they're going to have that year, you know, and they've have all sorts of new ideas and they're excited about the new curriculum. And, you know, so I kind of look at it from that standpoint. I raise the dogs and, you know, I see their potential and things that I've learned. And then you wait several years to be able to actually develop them and bring them when you think they're most ready to the Iditarod Trail or to the greatest testing grounds. And so it's exciting, you know, that's very exciting. And to add to that is the friends that I've made over the years throughout rural Alaska, and I can't hardly wait to see them. And many times now, the only time I get to see them is in the spring when I'm traveling across the state by dog team, and so it's something I really look forward to, and that brings that same excitement and looking forward to getting out there. But in the old days, you know, first of all, we had no guarantee what kind of trail we were going to see. There was not nearly as much effort put on trying to make it be a race trail as just to clear it, get some way to mark something so we could eventually find our way across. I'll never forget in 1980 we were going across the Farewell Burn, and I was traveling across here with Rudy Demoski and Don Honey and Ken Chase. And we would lay our dog teams down, and then we'd all fan out and try to find a marker. And then somebody'd go, oh, it's over here. And, you know, we'd go back and get our dog teams and head over, except for Ken Chase, who had this really great leader named Piper. And he would just whistle, and Piper would then bring the team over if the sled didn't get hung up on 10 downed trees on his way over to where the marker was. But it took us, you know, 20-some hours to get across the Farewell Burn because we had to do that kind of an operation to find our way across.
So it's just an adventure to get to Nome, essentially.
It was. It was an adventure to get there, exactly. And, you know, like I said, nobody had handlers. Some people were lucky enough to have kids, and their kids were their handlers. But all of us were doing, you know, all the hard work at home and the training and in many cases, the guys were building their own sleds because, you know, there weren't nearly as many sled builders as there are today, and sewing their own harnesses, and there wasn't, you know, quite as many people knowing about even, we only used booties on bad feet, you know, we didn't know about the benefits of using booties on feet to keep them from ever being bad feet, and at that time, we taped them on with electrician tape or with athletic tape, you know, and none of this Velcro stuff and this quick and easy putting boots on the dogs and moving on down the trail thing.
Yeah, yeah, and that explains some of the amazing times that are turned in now compared to back then. It's gotten, I wonder if there's been a limit reached and how fast you can actually get to Nome with the dog team.
Well, I don't know if that limit's been hit yet, but definitely there's been a lot of shortcuts. I mean, another one was on the bottoms of our runners. You know, we used to screw those things on and countersink the plastic in, if in fact you were using plastic. But my first race, I remember Herbie Nyakpuk was almost a full day ahead of me running on ivory runners.
Wow.
And of course, nowadays, you know, we have runners that we can just yank off with snow conditions and put something on, and we could change runners in 5-10 minutes. It was a big process, and you didn't change your runner unless you really were worn out and had to back in the early days.
Yeah, you have to go find a walrus first, I guess, huh?
Yeah, go get a walrus, harvest it, and get it in shape. But, I mean, you know, the thing was, Herbie was running third place on ivory runners.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it wasn't just that he was using his, you know, historic means. He was competitive.
Right. I asked this question of Craig Medrid and Dallas Seavey earlier in the hour, and I'd be really interested in your response because you've been a top musher for so long. What is it that divides out the winner, the second place from like the fifth, sixth, seventh? It seems like they're all so strong. They're all so experienced and they're all such tough competitors. Is it just sort of when you get up to those very top divisions, is there an element of luck there, or what is it that
there is an element of luck? There really is. Of course, you know, you try to make luck be on your side with anticipating as many different situations as your experience allows you knowledge of, and having your food drops prepared to be able to handle storms, or being hung up someplace, or, you know, being prepared with repair equipment for fixing places that you traditionally will break your sled, or runner plastic for snow conditions that you might see. You know, all of those different kinds of things that experience would give you the best indication of how to be prepared for it. But then there's the unknown, you know, the luck issue, the wiles of the individuals, but also, you know, look at what Lance did with Jeff driving the stronger team.
Right.
You know, in that one race in particular. I would not call that luck.
Every once in a while, there's a team that seems like it'd be almost a different kind of animal and just takes off from everybody else.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, part of that then is, that is luck, that the team came together at that time, that everybody's healthy, that none of the viruses or little bugs that might possibly come together hit that team that year. You know, those are some of the things that you do the best you can, and then there is a bit of divine intervention on whether your team is affected by it or not.
And what is your edge this year? I mean, what's your do you think that you're in better shape than you've ever been, or do you have a you obviously sound pretty confident.
I have a very good feeling about the depth of my team, the number of dogs that run lead, the number of dogs that have run lead racing this season. I just have a really good feeling about them. I don't think I'm going to have any issues with females in heat, because I only have one female and she's already been in heat.
Oh, good.
I've just got a lot of things that can be irritations that can cost you a position or two dealt with. And, I think the unknown for me is going to be getting across from the Post River to the Farewell Lakes in particular, where the new burn was last summer. And that part of the trail is really rough, and, you know, it's going to be shades of the old school days when we first had that burn out there. And so breaking a sled in there, getting in trouble in that part of the trail is if I get through there in good shape and in a good position, I would think the team is very much a threat.
So where would we be watching a checkpoint to for that relates to where you're talking about?
Rhone de Nicolai.
Okay. Okay. You heard it here first, folks. I wanted to ask you one more, two more questions. I wanted to ask you about your sponsors and how you pay for all this in just a minute. But I also, since I was talking to Dallas CV, and he's only 23 years old, and he's obviously just a young, tough dude. And you are, you've said you've been mushing already for 30 years, so you're obviously quite a bit older. Is there a physical aspect to this where it gets tougher and you think about being up against a guy like that, or how do you counter that?
That's one of the things I love about mushing is wisdom and judgment play as big a role as physical strength. So yeah, I'm compromised physically in ways that, Dallas is not, particularly, you know, as a cancer survivor and being in a bad car accident, and you know, mm-hmm. I had 10 surgeries in 9 years, so I mean, not like I'm dealing with the same body I entered with in 1980, but I have judgment and I have wisdom on my side and I have patience, and the youth are not necessarily known for patience.
Yeah. You know what, Didi, we've all followed your career for so many years and through the ups and downs and the car accident and the cancer and everything else. And I think that you're definitely a favorite for a lot of people. We'd really love to see you win. Go ahead and mention your sponsors and how you're paying for everything. And I sure appreciate you being with us today.
Well, I appreciate that. And I am sponsored by Taco Bell, and one of the joint promotions that Taco Bell and I do to try to contribute to the community is through the month of March, you can go into your local Taco Bell franchise and donate $1 to the Providence Cancer Center. And last year, through that promotion, all that money goes directly to the Cancer Center as it being my special charity, and we raised $45,000 through Iditarod Fans last year to contribute to the Cancer Center. And as you know, that's a near and dear to my heart. That's not money that goes into financing my team, but it finances my passion, and that is that we would find a cure and we would be able to better treat Alaskans that have to face cancer. My mom is still in that fight. And Shell Exploration and Petroleum are supporting my efforts this year as well. And Eagle Pack Premium Dog Food are supporting. There's four of us in particular, but they are the official dog food of the Iditarod this year. So they've actually expanded their program to help all the dogs on the trail, including all the drop dogs. So those are primary sponsors of mine. And then some of the local Valley ones are All Creatures Vet Clinic has been with me for many, many years, as has Valley Chiropractic Clinic that he probably has one of the most single contributors to the fact that this 57-year-old body can still be whacked on down the trail.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much for being with us, Didi John Rowan. Good luck out there. We'll be watching you pass through the checkpoints.
Thank you so much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, that was great. I really enjoyed talking to her, Didi John Rowan. And I'm excited about my next guest, too. Charles Wolforth here. The show is Hometown Alaska. And now I welcome Zach Steer to the show. Zach, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, good afternoon, Charles.
And Zach, for those who don't know, is a musher who is a former Iditarod musher, maybe former and future, we'll find out, and has the Sheep Mountain Lodge up on the Glen Highway, which is just a fantastic place to go in the wintertime, especially if you're a cross-country skier. It's paradise up there, and especially in the coming months, you know, in March, when the snow starts to get soft here in Anchorage. It's still great up there. Anyway, Zach, thanks for being with us. And you mushed the Iditarod how many times?
I've done the Iditarod 6 times. I scratched 1 year, so I've had 5 finishes.
Uh-huh. And have you hung up your mushing, or you're still mushing competitively?
Oh, we still have dogs here up at the lodge, and, you know, we are mushing recreationally now. You know, I sort of take it 1 year at a time. I'm not a professional dog musher like Didi or some of the other mushers you've talked to here. I enjoy doing the sport, and I enjoy competing against the pros, but it really is more of a hobby and a passion for me and not a career.
Yeah. Well, what does it take to have mushing as a hobby? It seems like it would be pretty all-consuming with the amount of effort it is to take care of that many dogs and to keep them exercised. I mean, it's not like something you can just drop for a while and come back to, right?
Well, it only takes 2 things to be a dog musher, you know, time and money. It's real simple. As long as you got time and money, you could be a dog musher. No, I mean, it takes a full-time commitment, especially if you want to compete at the level, you know, at the top levels of distance dog racing, just because the time commitment to train your team through the winter season, you know, really is the one of the biggest challenges of doing the sport for most people. You really can't hold down a full-time job if you want to be a dog musher in the wintertime. That's why you see a lot of mushers that have, you know, sort of seasonal occupation. There's a lot of commercial fishermen that are dog mushers. There's a lot of summer tourism operators like myself who are dog mushers. You know, those sort of lifestyles fit into the dog mushing sport.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, is it a good, I mean, is it something you're able to do with your family and kids and everybody else able to mush, or is it, so do you have to be pretty good at it before you can really do it?
Oh, no, anybody can do it. I mean, I would encourage anybody, in the Anchorage area especially, you can, go out to the Chugiak dog track, go out to the Tudor track on a weekend, and anybody can participate. It only takes one dog and a sled. You don't even need a sled. You can have skis, the ski jurors. There, we consider them part of the dog mushing community. And personally, I really do try to involve the family in the mushing. I've got two young boys. They did their first dog sled race just last week in the two-dog division. And,
And how old are they?
Oh, they're 5 and 8.
All right.
And, I mean, I think I was more nervous watching the 5-year-old take off strapped to two dogs than I was strapped to 16 at the start of the Iditarod.
Right. Yeah. That's hoping those dogs come back, right?
Yeah. Right.
Well, that's pretty good. But in terms of if it's a hobby, you still need to be out exercising the dogs frequently, right? You can't just leave them tied up.
Well, certainly. Yeah. I mean, and we do that here at the lodge, we take the dogs out for fun, for shorter runs, but it's very different when you're training recreationally versus when you're making the commitment to do a race like Iditarod. It really becomes a full-time job. Their time requirement to train the dogs, to get them prepared and get the miles on them that they need to be properly prepared, to do a race like that.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you're looking at the field of racers, do you sort of think about, well, who might win this year and what are the factors? Or even for somebody who knows a lot of mushing, is it kind of hard to do that? I mean, I know them sort of just by the reputation of what I read in the newspaper, but I certainly would have no idea who is the most likely to win or anything like that.
Well, I don't even think the top mushers know who's most likely. There's so many different factors that come into play. I mean, of course, we all talk about, who we think might win, but, I think the reality is there's a core group of, probably 10 or 15 teams that could win the race, but, every year is so different. There's so many different variables, probably number one being Mother Nature itself, and there's no way to control those things. So it really takes a special combination of a properly prepared dog team, a well-experienced dog musher, a good trail, good decisions, and decisions that made that one year is the right decision, the next year could be the wrong decision. You just got to get lucky sometimes. So all those factors have to come into play, and that's sort of what determines, who the champion is at the end of the race.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, thinking back to the first time you ran the Iditarod, I would think that the range of decisions in front of you would be almost overwhelming. And you're by yourself most of the time, right? You're just sort of riding on the back of those runners in the dark most of the time. It must be kind of intimidating.
Well, it's probably one of the most challenging things any person could ever do in their life. I mean, ask yourself, what's the most challenging thing you've ever done? And then compound that by the fact that you're doing it outside, in the wilderness, in the cold, in the dark, like you said. You're entrusted with the care and responsibility of the dogs that are in front of you. And just the overwhelming challenge that you have. It really is truly one of the most difficult things. And so I have a lot of respect for the rookies that, one, just to sign up for the race, just to take on that challenge to begin with, let alone complete it. I mean, they're really champions just for getting to the start line.
Well, it seems like it's a recurrent Alaskan story is the rookie who underestimates the Iditarod. Every year you hear that story.
Every year there's a couple guys that just crash and burn. They think, oh, it can't be that bad. Or they watch the TV, the Iditarod video, and, oh, it doesn't look so bad there. Trust me, when they get out there and they see the harsh reality of going down the Yukon River and into a headwind, for hours on end when the temperatures are cold and things aren't going your way, and then you're tired and you're hungry and you're cranky, things can go downhill fast. And so, kind of like Didi was saying, you can have a lot of you can have a lot of youth and vigor, but, you know, that's where some maturity and experience can really, you know, pay dividends.
So that's sort of the getting through those tough times is maybe one of the hardest parts about it when it's just miserable.
Every musher, the top mushers, the champions, Lance, Martin, at some point during the race, I could just about guarantee you that every musher at some point says, what the heck am I doing out here? You know, things aren't going right. And what differentiates the good mushers from the bad ones is how they deal with that situation. And, you know, the good mushers have learned to turn those challenging situations, you know, into a positive effect, or at least to delay it long enough, you know, right, until they can get to a better situation on the trail.
So in terms of the physicality of it, you have a network of cross country ski trails up there, so I assume you're a pretty avid skier. It's not quite the same thing of having endurance, or maybe it is. I mean, how would those two sports combine? Because you're not really, you're most of the time the dogs are doing the majority of the work, right? So it's not like you have to have a super muscle tone or anything, or maybe you do.
I would say maybe 15 or 20 years ago you could get by with riding the runners, but you know, nowadays if you want to be a competitive dog musher, you got to be helping out just as much as those dogs. I can tell you from when you lead the race or when you're in the front pack, what you really notice is the footprints, the musher's footprints along the side of the trail, which means that there you are kicking and running and pulling the majority of the way. I mean, there's not a lot of mushers that are riding on the sled, you know, at least at the front of the pack. So, you know, the mushers' physical ability, their ability to contribute to the dog team's progress, I think really helps. I
mean, interesting.
I know personally, when I'm racing, everything that I can do to make it easier for my dogs is what I attempt to do. So I carry a big long ski pole and I run and kick and you know, whatever I can do to make it easier for the dogs, I'm gonna do my best there.
So in addition to putting out sort of a marathon physical effort, you have to string that together day after day. I mean,
it is the best weight loss program you can ever imagine.
Yeah.
You show me a musher that ends up at Nome fatter than when they started.
Sure. And what about the money? I mean, is this something that you, how much money do you need to run the Iditarod and get you with your own team and get everything together in a year?
Well, you know, it's not a cheap sport. It's not like, you know, in the Iron Dog, it's an expensive sport, but you can put your snow machine away in the summertime. And, you know, in the Iditarod, you got to care and feed for your dogs all year long. A number that gets thrown about, I figure it probably costs $1,000 per dog per year.
Wow. Hey, Zach, I really want to thank you for being with us. It's Zach Steer from Sheep Mountain Lodge. Musher, and really enjoyed talking with you today. Thanks for being with us.
Yep, thanks for having me, Charles.
This has been Hometown Alaska. My name is Charles Wolforth. I'll be back again, actually, in 2 days. Usually I have to wait weeks to be back with you, but on Friday we're having a special edition with Leanne Hansen, the longtime host of Weekend Edition Sunday, who's going to be here in Anchorage. That's Friday at 2 p.m. Pat Yak is Vice President of Public Media for KSKA. Kristen Spack engineered today's program, did a fantastic job as always. BD Trentina also helped. I'm Charles Wolforth. Thanks for being with us.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music for Hometown Alaska is Lead Dog, composed and performed by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Views expressed on Hometown Alaska are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available on our website at kska.org, and CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.